For the week of October 22nd, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 385, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Beijing at the 19th Party Congress, I'm Michael Giltz.
Wow. Okay, you sound pretty good for being all the way in Beijing.
Thank you, Skype.
Yes, exactly. But I guess what you're referring to is, I guess they're doing some politics over there in China this week.
Yes, they are in China. I mean, you know, we're all over China on our show. Okay. The truth is, I'm not in China. I was going to joke about being at the World Series ready for the next game, but unfortunately, the Yankees lost Game 7 against Houston, and they're not going to the World Series this year, so my hopes have been crushed.
Yes, and look, I'm a Yankees fan too. I would have been torn if the Yankees made it, because of course it would have been the Yankees versus the LA Dodgers. But, you know,
then you're not a Yankees fan.
No.
Why would you be torn?
So I offer my condolences about the Yankees.
Yes, well, they were great games. They were exciting. The team is well positioned for the future. But what's interesting is that I rarely watch live sporting events on TV. And I did a lot of it the last 3 days. And I have a question for you. Are you cooking a lot of pasta?
I am, actually.
Are you really? Because when you watch live sports on TV, there's like multiple ads for products to cook your pasta. Like, this is some big, oh, people hate the difficulty of making pasta, but it's so wonderful. Try our, you know, cook pasta in the microwave, cook pasta with this machine. I was like, what's going on? Are people making a lot of pasta suddenly? It was one thing after another. That plus the Scotty vest. Have you ever heard of this thing? It's a vest or like a jacket with pockets for everything. Who needs a bag? You put your tablet, your phone, your keys, wallet, cords, small children, bottled water. These vests carry everything inside them. You're just supposed to walk down the street with everything you own shoved into your vest. It's completely bizarre.
But they also play on insecurities, okay? So there's a ton of insurance commercials, whether it's car insurance or Progressive or Geico, you know, save on home insurance. And then I know that you found one, a testosterone booster. So, you know, the male ego, they're playing off the insecurities there.
That's right. It's the Ageless Male Max. And you're supposed to use it, I guess, for working out and stuff, but it's also for wink, wink, gaining weight. But hey, it also increases sexual arousal 67%. And they do tell you if the results are too intense, you know, please decrease use. You're like, what? Get me that.
My problem with all of this is that the commercials are so repetitive. I just want to say, look, get new commercials, or at least rotate the commercials in and out. I don't need to see the same commercial 12 times during one game.
During one game, yeah, I don't get that. I don't know what, I mean, I guess they say you have to see something 3 times before the message sticks. But yeah, it's very tiresome when you're watching. Plus, there's so many of them. But that's what happens when you watch a live sporting event. But what happens when you listen to our podcast this week?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we'll discuss the latest news from China. Heck, maybe we should rename this podcast, actually, China Biz Box Office. In any case, the spy spoof Kingsman is very happy to be a hit in the Middle Kingdom. We'll also dive back into theater, since Michael is a verified fan, indeed he is, and had a chance to buy Harry Potter tickets, and it was the least exciting 2.5 hours he's ever spent. During our book filter segment, Michael won't help anyone spot a book to develop for Hollywood. Sometimes you just have to state the obvious, so he's going to point out all the books that they have already optioned. On Inside Baseball, we will dive deep into the spreading and pretty remarkable story of sexual harassment throughout the entertainment industry. It has grown from just a saga of Harvey Weinstein into a day of reckoning that is reaching directors and agents and executives in Hollywood to encompass the book industry, music, gaming, and much more. But will it lead to lasting change? Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines, but first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from you, our viewers, and Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, The Numbers, The LA Times, The New York Times, Variety, Hollywood Reporter. Apparently, we just go everywhere to get the information. And when you put it all together, the number one movie around the world is Kingsman, The Golden Circle. It did open up in China, $52 million on the weekend, $345 million worldwide, which means it's probably going to pretty much match the $400 million worldwide take of the first Kingsman movie. Made less money in North America. It's making more money overseas. The reviews are not as good, but they're clearly going to have a Kingsman 3.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, come on.
Sure, absolutely. Why not? Money to be made. At number two is Gerard Butler's Geostorm, $50 million on its opening weekend, $63 million overall because it opened up in some other territories earlier, I guess. Now, was this such a bomb? It cost $120 million to make, but they even skipped the Thursday night opening.
Wow.
They said, we're not going to open up on Thursday because too many people will find out by Friday that it's a bad movie. You've heard of movies skipping reviews, of course, but skipping the Thursday night opening when it should normally open is kind of like saying, well, we're not going to open up on Friday. We'll just open it up on Saturday and Sunday. Maybe nobody will notice. I mean, it's just what a bizarre tactic.
Geostorm is actually one of those movies that did not get, you couldn't review it. They did not have.
Right. Again, what a surprise. It's been delayed from March of 2016. There was a silly analysis in the Hollywood Reporter. What went wrong? It's like, well, it's a bad movie. Yeah. Like, what do you mean, what went wrong?
Actually, Jim Amos in Celluloid Junkie this week, I edited his piece for the box office piece, and he went into this whole thing about, everybody's pondering why this weekend was so bad and why this weekend was so down, and the MIT scientists are getting together, and it's really just very simple. You made bad movies.
Well, there's going to be ups and down weeks. It's just what happens. There's a calm before the storm of, hitting into the fall season. We've already got, of course, at number three, Tyler Perry's Boo 2, A Madea Halloween, $22 million on the weekend. That's pretty much the total budget of the film, including marketing, I think, according to one report. So that's a great start for that film. At number four is Blade Runner 2049, $21 million on the weekend, just under $200 million worldwide.
I better go and see this movie before it leaves theaters.
Yeah, and it does have an opening scheduled for China. At number five is It, $16 million on the weekend, $650 million worldwide, and another Halloween-friendly movie. That's three in a row, practically. Not in a row, but Tyler Perry, It, and now Happy Death Day. $15 million on the weekend, $53 million. So that's a huge success story.
Have you seen the trailer for this movie? Because it really looks like the horror version of Groundhog Day.
Well, that's exactly what it is. Yeah. That's how they pitched it.
Yeah.
It's Groundhog Day, but with death. But I did watch the trailer for Same Kind of Different as Me, which is way down at number 22. It made $2 million on its opening weekend in North America. It's a film starring Greg Kinnear and Renee Zellweger and Jaimin Hunsu. The description made me kind of nauseous. It's about an international art dealer and a homeless man who become best friends. And no points for guessing which actor plays which role.
Let me guess. Jaimin Hunsu is the international art dealer because, of course, he's got an international name.
Sadly, no. Oh. But the reason I looked at the trailer is because the Guardian reviewer said it was like the most offensive trailer he's ever seen. And it was sort of a magical Negro trailer. It was kind of obnoxious and vile. Does not make you want to see the film. Though I did watch the trailer for, is it Tailor Made? Or what's the name of the, they've given a name now to the Daniel Day-Lewis, Paul Thomas Anderson film.
Oh, they have.
And it was a lovely, it's called Phantom Thread. And it was an interesting trailer. Interesting. I'm intrigued to see it. And, Day-Lewis is so compelling immediately that you think, oh, what a shame that he may quit acting. But that takes us back
in it,
to
does he say, I drink your milkshake?
That brings us back to the charts. Way up at number seven is Never Say Die, a Chinese body-swapping comedy based on a play, of course. $15 million on the weekend, and it has now passed the $300 million mark. And we're saying that movie is number seven, but when you're looking at worldwide box office, the ranking here doesn't really matter. What matters is the individual movie and how much it costs to make and how much it's grossing. And in this case, it's a big success story. And number eight is The Snowman, which we now have a new budget estimate for of $35 million, which is radically different from the $5 million, which was the only amount we saw reported before. This is more believable. $10 million on the weekend, $22 million, and a lot of poor reviews, unfortunately, for that film. At number nine is the Jackie Chan flick, The Foreigner, $8 million on the weekend, $117 million worldwide. At number 10 is Bad Genius. This is a Thai film. We have now an estimate on its budget of $2 million, which I guess sort of makes sense for a small Thai film, but it's done great at the box office. $7.6 million on the weekend, $42 million worldwide. And yes, Hollywood should be remaking this one right away.
And $7.6 million in three territories.
Right. We're not thinking this is the film that's going to necessarily translate and play in 70 or 80 territories.
No, but I mean, that's pretty good is what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah, it's great. It's terrific. It's in China, I think.
I think that, that's where that it opened up. It has recently. To be, because, you know, how do you make that much money in, you know, in some of these territories where, like Thailand, I don't know how you would make that much money in one weekend.
Well, you don't. And number 11 is the Lego Ninjago movie. That passes the $100 million mark. And number 12 is The Outlaws.
By the way, just so you know, Bad Genius came in number 3 at the box office this past weekend, earning $2.56 million.
In China alone.
In China alone.
Terrific. Do we count that as an international film? We do, right? As when we're looking at the unofficial metric of how many international films can be released in China, that has obviously gone completely by the wayside. We keep an ongoing list of that. But, I mean, that's an international film, Thailand, so that's another one to add to the list. It's a little harder to keep track of non-Hollywood ones. But it's supposed to be a ban on all films. You know, there's supposed to be, what was the official, unofficial number? It was, the whole quota was 34.
Imported films. Historically, right. That had been mostly Hollywood films.
Right. So Bad Genius would be included in that because that's an international film. So that probably opened up around October 20th or something like that. And that takes our total up to well over 40. I think we're at like 48 and counting now. So 48 to 50 movies are opening up in China this year already. That includes the expected release of Blade Runner and Geostorm on Friday. So they have blown past that quota system that is long gone. You can pretend that's over with, right? That is done.
Yeah. Now, do you want to know something interesting about Bad Genius?
Sure.
546,414 admissions.
Where?
In China.
Okay. I don't know how to put that into context for China since we don't get a lot of reporting on admissions. But
well,
that's interesting. Half a million people went to see it.
Yeah, and over 2 million people went to see The Kingsman.
There you go. Moving along, The Outlaws, the Korean flick, made another $6 million on the weekend. That's at $33 million worldwide. My Little Pony is at $35 million worldwide. And some good reviews for the film at number 14. It opened up in North America. It's Only the Brave, a firefighting movie, which has a good, solid critical support for it, though it's not really catching fire or getting a lot of attention. It cost $35 million to make, so it's got a long road to go. But nice reviews help. That certainly doesn't hurt. And scrolling down, I don't see anything new here until I get down to Golmaal Again. This is a Hindi film. It's the fourth in a series. This one flashes back to our heroes as kids where they were orphans. And then now as adults, they're sort of lovable, you know, street con artists. Nice con men, you know, nice, lovable con men. This is the fourth in a series. It opened up in North America and in India at the same time. It's in 10 territories, actually. In North America, it made $1 million here in the U.S. on a couple hundred screens. But its total worldwide, reported by Comscore, is only $2.4 million. So that makes no sense to me. If it made $1 million in North America alone, you would think it had to have done better in India. And also, this Golmaal series is really popular. The third one was the second highest grossing movie of the year in India.
Oh,
so
wow.
Golmaal 3 was a big, big hit. So why this one would open up in 10 territories and $1 million was made in the U.S., but its total is only $2.4 million. I'm scratching my head here. I don't understand this. I see a reported budget, maybe of $15 million.
Well, okay. Here's why this might be. Ticket prices.
No, I know. They spent $50 million to make it. The last one was the highest grossing movie, the second biggest grossing movie of the year. That it would open up to $1.4 million in India seems confounding.
Well, again, what I'm saying is a lot of people may have seen it in India. However, ticket prices might be so low that $1.5 million, which is, you know, just
but then they wouldn't spend $15 million to make it.
Yeah,
we almost never see a film, an Indian film, make more money in the U.S. or about the same as it does in India. That doesn't happen typically.
Typically,
it was so popular that people in the U.S. flocked to it and they spent $1 million. It doesn't make any sense to me that it only made another $1 million in India. And plus, you're talking 8 other territories beyond that. It did get poor reviews, though I don't think the others got any better. One review said it was marginally better than Golmaal 3. I don't know if you can put that on a billboard. Marginally better than the last one in the series. But again, I'm a little confused by this movie. I understand ticket prices are lower in India. They make lower money, less money overall. But this is a big property. It costs maybe $15 million to make. And if you know the answer to this puzzle, or if you can say, no, those are the right numbers, let us know.
Yeah, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/showbizsandbox. All of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com.
That's right. And going towards the bottom of the list that we have, there's a French-Belgian animated film. It's called The Son of Bigfoot, which I jokingly thought might be a sequel. Like the first movie was Bigfoot, and this is The Son of Bigfoot. No, it's not a sequel, but it's about a teenage boy trying to track down his missing dad in the woods. And it turns out his dad is, in fact, Bigfoot. And they're both being hunted by a mega corporation named Hair Co. because they believe, for some reason, that Bigfoot's DNA could solve male baldness. This what is a bizarre idea for an animated film.
This has got that to be a comedy. Well, it's an animated film, so yeah.
It made $2.3 million on the weekend. It's in 13 territories, and its total is $27 million. I don't know where that came from, because this is the first I remember hearing of it.
Yeah, I don't know where. Yeah, I agree with you.
So there you go. You know, sometimes movies pop onto the charts. We're like, oh, there you are. Because it's a big, wide world out there. So again, we just gave you the information. When you hear about a big hit film and it should be on our charts, it's made enough money, let us know, because we're relying on ComScore and some scattered information from the American media. And they don't always know what's going on in Africa and Asia and Europe. So, you know, we depend on you to let us know. Here in North America, in limited release, Wonderstruck by Todd Haynes opened very softly. That was interesting. That was one of the films that played at the New York Film Festival and at Cannes. I didn't think it was very good, and it's, I think, going to quickly disappear. In contrast, The Killing of the Sacred Deer by Greek director Yorgos Lanthimos had a nice strong opening, but that's not going to be a big, wide commercial play. But it's nice to see that movie getting some attention. And I'm really bummed that the French drama about French AIDS ACT UP, BPM, collapsed at the box office here in the U.S. No one went to see that movie when it opened up in limited release. So that's a shame, because that is one of the best films of the year.
Yeah, I was not as hot on it as everybody else.
Well, there you go. You just don't like French people, or you don't like gay people?
No, I just, you know, I didn't find it all that engaging. It's certainly emotionally moving, but not as I don't know. I found it kind of flat for me.
Well, audiences agreed with you. And Wanda Group is not having a great time. They've lost an executive. A senior VP has left the company, Jack Gao. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name.
Yeah, Gao. Jack Gao.
Okay, great. Is this a sign of turmoil? What's going on here? Do you know?
Well, I think if you were to ask me from the outside, I would say that Jack Gao has worked for Microsoft. He's worked for News Corp. He was brought into Wanda, that is, at a time when Wanda was expanding overseas with Legendary Entertainment and Dick Clark Productions, and doing all of this international acquisitions where they were going to be producing films overseas and producing television overseas. And all of a sudden, the Chinese government has said, you know what? No, you got to start focusing your money and your energies here in China. And so Wang Jianlin of the Dalian Wanda Group, the head of the Dalian Wanda Group, all of a sudden there, he says, for the short term, we'll be focusing our energies in the Chinese market. Well, Jack Gao, that's not where his energies were focused. So I think he's leaving.
So he had nothing to do.
Pretty much.
I get it. And this week in reboots and adaptations and spinoffs, Nancy Drew, the Nancy Drew reboot is being rebooted. This was a TV series planned for NBC. The original reboot idea was moronic. It was about a New York City detective and had literally nothing to do with the books, except she had the same name as Nancy Drew. I mean, it was literally like they're just using the name. Now this reboot of that reboot at least has a link to the books. It's very meta. This Nancy Drew is about the author of the Nancy Drew books, and she gets drawn into a mystery as an adult, and she calls on her childhood friends to help her solve the mystery. And her childhood friends are the people who inspired those iconic characters in the books, and they resent how she portrayed them in the books. So that's their tension, and she's the author of a mystery series, and now she's going to have to solve a crime for real. At least it has something tangentially to do with Nancy Drew. And the other reboot is at CBS, where they are bringing back Magnum P.I. To me, Magnum P.I. is nothing but the appeal of Tom Selleck.
Yeah, I mean, that is not a
high concept. I mean, I know he's a former military guy who lives in Hawaii. It's a nice setting and he solves crime. But there's nothing to that other than the fact that he's Tom Selleck. You cast the right actor and he just was appealing. There's nothing in that show that is worth redoing. It's just, if you can get Tom Selleck, great. You know, Maverick, okay, that has something to it. Lots of other shows have a high concept or something you can draw into, something, Wild Wild West. You know, it's a concept. You had the right actors as well. But Magnum P.I., it's just Tom Selleck. What the heck is there to reboot if you don't have him?
Well, those are reboots in movies and television. What about reboots or actually expansions on Broadway? Isn't that... one of the things you wanted to talk about this week was your attempt, that is, to get tickets to Harry Potter and the Cursed Child on Broadway.
Well, let's not say attempt. I did. What's your impression of Verified Fan?
Well, for me, okay, as you know, Michael, because you were on the phone with me when it happened and kind of guiding me through, should I get this ticket or that ticket? Because for some reason in your brain, you have the seating chart for every Broadway theater. The Verified Fan is a way you kind of register for a production. In my case, it was Springsteen on Broadway. And then they
make sure you're a real person and not just an account created 2 weeks ago so that scalpers can gain access and create millions of accounts. And it works, right?
Yeah, they go and they look at your Twitter account. They go and they look at your Facebook and they say, oh my God, this guy's been to like 6 Springsteen shows. He is definitely a fan. And then they put all of those people, the people that they have verified, into a pool. And then from there, they pull out, you know, a lottery. And then they put the people who didn't win the lottery on a waiting list. And I won the lottery. I got to buy tickets the day they went on sale. Now, mind you, those tickets were, I think, on my left or right arm plus my eyeballs. I mean, it was
different issue.
Totally different issue. But I must say, when tickets went on sale, it was a little nerve-wracking, but I was able to get tickets, okay? I, a fan, was able to get tickets.
And that hasn't been the case in years for a big show, right?
Correct.
If you're talking about Springsteen at Madison Square Garden or, you know, U2 or somebody, if you go online when the tickets go on sale, they're gone in 5 seconds, right?
Correct, yes.
Yeah, so that is a change. But what was the media response you heard from the Harry Potter tickets going on sale? Your immediate reaction to me was...
What? I didn't even know they were going on sale.
That's right. You didn't know that. But then today you said that Verified Fan failed again.
Yeah, I had heard, you know, I saw like one or two headlines that said it's another fail for Verified Fan, which I immediately thought to myself, I should read this article because I have a feeling it's a fail for that one person.
Right. And again, by fail, they mean I didn't win the lottery and get to try and buy tickets.
Right.
And also the website seemed overwhelmed with people. So here's what happened for me. I was a Verified Fan because I'm a real person. I won the lottery and I got a code to try and buy tickets for Harry Potter. Not for me, but for a friend because I can't afford them and I'm hoping to get to review it. So I got a code. You log on and it tells you to use the latest version of Chrome. Make sure you're there. Do not refresh your browser. Do not close out and go back in again because you need a code to log into the website. And once you've used it once, you can't use it again. So you can't. If your computer crashed or something, or you accidentally closed out your browser, if you wanted to log back in and go back to the website, you couldn't do it. And they said, don't refresh your browser. Big notice, leave it alone. Don't open multiple tabs. Don't refresh your browser. You'll screw it up and you may be locked out. And again, you need a code just to log onto the site. And if you use it once, you're done. Once you're in, you got to stay in. So I'm like, okay. So I go online, I log in, I pick a date. I realize, you know, it's not the date I thought. My friend wants to see both parts of the play on one day. So I had to pick another date. I chose it. The seating chart was useless because they've just gutted this entire theater. So it's a brand new setup. They pushed the back wall forward. They've done some other things. They've reconfigured it. So you really wanted to look at the seating chart. And in fact, they'll show you roughly where your seats are, but it's not an actual seating chart where you get to look and see exactly the numbered seats in the row. It's just sort of like you're kind of there. That was annoying. I also couldn't pick my seats. They only really let you sort of do best available. That was annoying too, even though they claimed that was an option. So I did it. I picked the date. I clicked on it. And my browser started to spin and spin and spin and spin. Apparently other people, when I looked online, people after half an hour or 10 minutes or 15 minutes would get frustrated and they'd refresh or they'd go back. I was scared. I was like, if I do this, it's not going to work. 2.5 hours.
Oh, wow.
2.5 hours. It never logged in. Finally, I said, well, this is stupid. I've run out of time. I'll just refresh. I refreshed and immediately got in and was able to get tickets. So it's like, well, that was stupid and annoying. I should have done it after 10 minutes, but I knew it took you like 10 or 15 minutes to get in.
It took close to 8 minutes, if you recall.
Right. And again, they were so adamant about, hey, you need a thing to log in. And if you refresh or get off the page, you'll never get back in again. I was kind of scared and I didn't want to blow it for this person that I was trying to buy tickets for. So I was able to do it because it took me so long. I didn't get the seats I wanted. She was willing to spend whatever. But again, it's a 2-part play. She bought 4 tickets. It was $1,600.
Oh, my God.
Well, it's 4 people going to 2 plays. So it's really $800 a play. It's $200 a ticket. It's a lot of money, and it's 4 people. But yeah, she was willing to spend up to $3,200, but because I got locked out, I wasn't able to do that. They were gone.
So what you're saying is she is paying $200 per ticket, per show for the cheap seats.
Right.
So that
means...
Well,
not for the cheap seats. They were on the orchestra seats. They were on the far side, I think. It may be against the wall, but it's a very big, expansive theater. It's probably row 15 to 17. It's not clear if there's double A, double B, because that wasn't spelled out on the chart. Again, it was just a generic, here's the orchestra section, and here's where your seats are, sort of. They didn't label seats or rows. You couldn't check any chart because it's a brand new theater. They gutted the interior. So it's a little vague, but I think she's probably row 15 to 17, which is farther back than I'd like. I don't know if it's under the overhang, but, you know, what are you going to do? However, social media online really tells you something interesting. It's the same story as Bruce Springsteen. The cheap tickets sold out first.
Yes, and that's something that I had a friend that just as it happened, got tickets for the very same day I did for Bruce Springsteen. As you know, Michael, I had to sell my tickets. I sold them at face value. Okay, so I didn't make any money. I was not able to go. And that said, you know, he got tickets. He did not want the most expensive tickets, but he found, like many people, that the cheap tickets went first.
Yeah. So this is completely new, right? This is how high-priced tickets are on Broadway. This has not happened before. Usually you go to a rock concert, you go to a Broadway show, the best seats sell first.
Correct.
Because you're excited, because you want to see it. You're a big fan, you want to go, and you're even going to pay a little more than people normally would, but the ticket prices are so high, people are flocking to the back seats. You could, hours later, you could still buy, I mean, it was 2.5 hours after tickets went on sale, I was still able to buy better than cheap tickets. You know, the absolute top premium were gone, but all the cheaper tickets were gone. So I was stuck in the middle range of paying $200 to $300 a ticket. That was where it was at. So that's a really big change. And that tells me they're really overpricing tickets.
Yeah. I mean, look, I did not want to pay $750 per ticket to see Bruce Springsteen on Broadway. And I love the guy, but, you know, he might be the only person I would do that for. And in the end, I didn't, okay? Because I didn't go.
Because it's too much money.
Right. And for Hello Dolly to see Bette Midler at $600 per ticket, guess what? Not going to do it.
Well, it's $1,000 towards the end of her run.
Yeah, so it's...
Face value.
Yeah, and so forget it. I mean, it's just not... It's not worth it.
And Broadway is kidding themselves that, oh, no, there's lots of tickets. People know. It's just, you know, it's great when there's a show that's this popular because all, you know, a rising... tide lifts all boats. No, no, no. You're really getting out the message that Broadway is way too expensive. In one story that we linked to, people in the industry are saying, no, 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 there's tons of cheap tickets available. Don't worry about it. And their example is a couple goes to TKTS and buys tickets to Prince of Broadway, a review of director Hal Prince's career. And this show is about to close. It got terrible reviews. It's 3/4 empty, and their tickets cost $85 each.
Okay.
You know, and there's a quote from Lawrence F. Maslin, a theater historian and arts professor at NYU. He said, quote, back in the day, you could buy the worst seat in Broadway and it was 25% of a full ticket price. Now the worst seat on Broadway is 85% of a full price ticket, meaning, you know, you're starting much higher than you used to. There are no cheap tickets available and they're going to kill fans for a generation.
Yeah, well, welcome to the opera.
Exactly.
But you know what? I think if that happens, if the industry is killed off, somebody will write a book about this time period. And then you and your team over at bookfilter.com will actually tell us whether we should read it or not.
I bet you're right.
Because Bookfilter is a book lover's best friend. And every week you over at Bookfilter, you kind of tell everybody, hey, here's all the books that are coming out and here's the ones that are worth reading. Here at Showbiz Sandbox, you bring by a few books that maybe Hollywood or the entertainment industry should be thinking about, whether it's for television shows or movies. These are the books that are worth paying attention to.
That's right. That's what I do. And this week, there's two books. They're just obvious ones. I'm sure they've been optioned or people are aware of them. One is by Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone. It's called I Can't Breathe. And it's the story of Eric Garner, the man who was killed by New York City police officers via a chokehold. And it's just a terrific nonfiction book. I mean, I read Taibbi a lot on Rolling Stone. It took me a while to warm up to his sort of snarky attitude on the magazine and his use of language and cursing, which is like, oh, it seemed childish. But his reporting is so good that he really won me over the years. And I've come to really respect him as a journalist and a writer. And he's done a number of nonfiction books. I can't imagine any is better than this one because I Can't Breathe is really just sensational. It tells the story of Eric Garner and it tells the story of what happened and the whole history of NYPD policing and civil rights protests and black people in America, and just does it person by person. Each chapter is named after a different person, and it really brings Eric Garner to life as a human being, flawed, you know, complicated, no saint, no sinner, really, just a guy getting by who had the bad misfortune to be doing his business of selling loose cigarettes across the street from what was a fancy new condominium development in Staten Island. Basically, he was in this park for years, but now that there's a fancy building across the street, people don't want to look at this big, hulking black guy selling cigarettes across from their building. That's kind of what it comes down to as far as the harassment he faced and the eventual death that he suffered.
Right, and basically what wound up happening, and this was a big news story, is...
All over the world, yeah.
Yeah, he got choked, and he wound up being choked to death. I don't think it was purposeful, but in the end, you read the book, so... You tell me whether it was purposeful or not.
Well, it was certainly a case that should have gone to trial. And Matt Taibbi does a great job of both depicting Eric Garner's life, showing the complicated political machinations in Staten Island and New York. It's not a tirade. It's just a really in-depth, fascinating look at like the guy who came up with the Broken Windows program, how it's implemented in New York. It's just person after person, the judges, the prosecutors, the defense attorneys, the family members, the other people. It's just a sensational book, really gripping non-narrative, narrative nonfiction. I can't recommend it highly enough. I'm sure people are already working on all sorts of documentaries or stuff or whatever about this case. Whether any of them will work out to be good or interesting, I don't know, but he's certainly created a great book. And then the other obvious pick this week is a John Grisham book. It's The Rooster Bar, and I love the conceit of this book. It's about four young people who are all law students in a less-than-first-class law school program. And they realize kind of that they've been duped, that they've taken on massive student loans and they're attending a third-tier for-profit law school, which they figure out is so shoddy that its grads rarely pass the bar exam. Oh, and it's part of a chain of for-profit law schools owned by a sleazy New York hedge fund manager who also owns the company making them all those expensive loans. So they're like, we feel we're being screwed. And it's them going out to try and battle and prove the charade of what's going on, which just sounds like a really, 99%, exciting mystery cloaked in talking about inequality and how expensive college is. Just sounds really ripe for development.
Well, if any of those movies get made, I'm sure you'll let us know. Well, I'm sure we'll figure it out on our own.
That's right. We'll be hearing about it. It'll be a big deal.
Oh, wait. Okay. Well, if that's going to be a big deal, then how about some of the stories in our Big Deal, Big Whoop segment? Big Deal, Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, Netflix added 5.3 million subscribers worldwide. They added people in the U.S. and internationally, and can now boast of about 110 million subscribers worldwide. And yet, none of them will admit to actually enjoying the sitcom Fuller House. Go figure. Not a single one. Although my kids like that show. Don't ask me why. Netflix grossed just a smidge under $3 billion for the third quarter. Neither the new subscribers or revenue reflect price increases in the cost of a Netflix subscription for most people. The company says it will spend $7 billion to $8 billion in 2018 on all content. Ooh. Now, about 25% of that is on original content, and that number will continue to grow. And it won't just be TV shows. Netflix plans to release 80 films in 2018. So if you had $2 billion to spend on original TV shows and movies, what show would you greenlight? What movie would you greenlight? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I'd greenlight them all. Why not? Everything. I'm going to make everything.
You
when
probably
you got that
could.
Much money, it just seems like you don't have to choose. You know, we make fun of them. And I have to mention that I'm here in the suburbs. And just last night, without prompting, who was she with? Oh, my niece mentioned that she was with her, I don't know if he's a boyfriend or what, but a friend. And they watched an Adam Sandler movie.
Oh, my God.
And they watched one of the ones that he made for Netflix. I can't even remember what the name of it is, but it was one that he made for Netflix. You know, one of the four movies that he made for them that you like, you've never heard of and nobody saw, but he did it. And so it's like, you know what? People are watching them. Cause I thought 80 movies, that just seems like so many. What's the point? You know, TV shows seem to have a lot better, you know, use of their money, but, you know, people are watching the movies too, I guess. We've got the upcoming Will Smith movie, Bright, which is $90 million. We've got Scorsese and De Niro making a $100 million movie, The Irishman. It just, to me, that just, I don't understand showing an $80 million movie just on TV. I don't see the point of it, but clearly they're doing something right.
Well, it's one thing to do that with House of Cards, two seasons, which cost $100 million. Okay, you're getting how many episodes out of it?
Right,
okay.
20 episodes, yeah. And it's, you know, very playable. Or a miniseries, a TV miniseries. Maybe The Irishman will become a miniseries. It's not clear to me what the length of it is. Maybe they'll say, hey, let's make a six-hour miniseries. I don't know. But when you're talking about a two-hour movie and you're spending $90 million on it, to me, I'd want to make some of that back at the box office.
Well, up until recently, you haven't been able to tell who's watching what when it comes to Netflix. It's been frustrating for, well, you know, certainly entertainment journalists. We can attest to that ourselves. It's also been frustrating for the TV production companies and the you know, production companies, whether they're TV or film production companies, because they don't know whether their shows are successful. They just know, hey, we've been picked up again.
It's not frustrating for advertisers because there's no advertising.
Correct. However, Nielsen is now saying, guess what? We're going to start telling people who's watching what shows on Netflix.
And how can they do that? Just based on diaries that's self-submitted by people that are part of the Nielsen family?
I think not only diaries and surveys, I think they're also doing it by way of
in-house measurement.
Yes, exactly. In-house measurements and broadband surveys and kind of tracking stuff on a, you know, metadata level.
Well, especially since people are now doing it through their television, it should be a lot easier to track.
Exactly. That's what I mean.
But I still don't understand why there isn't anonymized data made available by cable companies. I mean, they're in 90 million homes. Why they wouldn't just say, all right, we can tell you exactly what people are watching on cable. We can't tell you who's in the room. We can at least tell you this TV was on and this is who's in the household and this is what they watched. And they could do it down to the second. And they could also now be telling you, no, this time was spent on YouTube. This time was spent on Netflix, because that's where they're doing it now. So all that data to me seems to be ready for the picking. I've never understood why they don't make an advantage of it.
Well, especially with switched cable, where, you know, it used to be that a cable provider would send all channels down to a cable box. Well, they said, well, geez, this is just a waste of bandwidth. So you know what we should do? Just send the channel that they're on. Okay, you're watching CNN, here's CNN. You're watching ESPN, here's ESPN. You're watching MTV, here's MTV. So the cable provider now knows which cable box is tuned to which channel. And so even if they said, hey, we don't have any information as to who is watching this, we just know that people, these boxes are tuned to this network. I could see them not wanting to get into the whole, we're providing data to, you know, we're anonymizing data and everything you do is, you know, Big Brotherish. I get it, but I agree.
But if you're a Nielsen family, I'd be happy to say, you know, I'd be happy to have my anonymized data used to track what I watch TV, because I want them to be supported.
Well, you know what you won't be watching on Netflix anymore?
What?
Chelsea Handler. She had that show three times a week. It was kind of a talk show.
Right. I never did watch it. Did you?
I watched like a couple of episodes and I never got into it. I was like, you know what? Yeah, no, this is not my type of show. It wasn't my type of show when she was on the E! Entertainment Network. It wasn't my show when she was on Netflix. And she says she's going to focus on political activism. But I think that it just wasn't going well. And a lot of people are pointing to this decision for her to leave, and possibly for Netflix to, you know, did she leave or did they cancel her? Who knows? But saying, you know what, there is some type of programming that television does better. And talk shows is one of them. That's kind
right.
of what
they said. We're not interested in live sports, but there's no reason why, since people watch, you know, The Daily Show and stuff on tape anyway, and say, you know, my brother sometimes tapes two or three, you know, the whole week, and then he ends up watching two or three episodes at a time. So there's no reason why a talk show couldn't work on Netflix, but this didn't crack the nut, I guess.
Yeah, there was just nothing. Again, I only watched three episodes, but it never caught on.
Well,
with
you're
me.
Not a fan, but clearly it's after 2 years, it's over. So clearly it didn't work for a lot of people.
Right. Now, you know what does work? Telling us stuff on Twitter. In fact, we learned it on Twitter, which seems to be the platform for everyone from presidents to pop stars. Justin Timberlake joked, I do have the time, half the time, and then linked to a humorous video that announced he would be performing on the Super Bowl halftime show. Of course, it was 14 years ago. He cameoed on Janet Jackson's halftime show, and the infamous wardrobe malfunction took place. Timberlake joins an illustrious list of superstars ranging from Bruce Springsteen and U2 to Beyonce and Bruno Mars, not to mention Up With People. The announcement comes just after his starring role in a Woody Allen film closed the New York Film Festival. And no surprise, but he's expected to have a new album out early next year. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, right?
Well, I mean, we kind of knew this was coming for about a week.
That's right.
It's a big whoop, yeah. I mean, it's great that they got him. They're trying to skew younger. Certainly a couple years ago they had Tom Petty in 2008, and I think
that's almost a decade. That's a decade ago.
Yes, a decade ago. Bruce Springsteen came after that. They're trying to skew younger. Coldplay was last year, I think it was. Beyonce, so you can tell what they're trying to do here. But
I think they're just trying to grab big mega superstars.
Yes, correct.
You know, that appeals to everyone, and Springsteen fits the bill, as does Justin Timberlake and Beyonce. I don't think it's a question of, you know, we've got to reach the kids. They're not getting Justin Bieber.
No.
Though he'll be there someday soon, I imagine.
That's probably true, sadly.
I just hope he keeps his clothes on. Well, just like Janet Jackson.
I agree. Actually, I think maybe Lady Gaga was last year. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Bowing to pressure from the Chinese government, YouTube has suspended new activity on the account of a Chinese dissident who has 500,000 followers and has been gaining attention for lengthy videos exposing alleged corruption by government officials. All the earlier videos of Guo Wengyu are still watchable, but because he's been given what's called a strike, and that's in quotes, he cannot post new videos for 90 days. YouTube is also blocking Guo from streaming YouTube videos onto the Twitter platform. And Facebook is restricting Guo's ability to post on a Chinese language account. This comes amidst the 19th Party Congress taking place right now as Chairman Xi Jinping consolidates power. Guo is based in the U.S. now and is a billionaire Chinese real estate developer. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. This isn't about the legitimacy of Guo. I'm not sure about him. I don't know anything about him other than the fact that he's a guy who made a lot of money and is now calling out other people. But it is a little concerning when you see these massive social media platforms taking these steps and not knowing whether they're legitimate steps or just under pressure to censor people because a large country doesn't want them to talk out.
Yeah, I mean, look, if he was in China and saying this, sure. Okay. YouTube.
He'd be in prison.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's one thing. Sure. YouTube, suspend him because he's breaking the laws possibly of that country, but he's in the U.S. Okay.
Well, I don't agree that, okay, dissidents should not be able to have access to international social media platforms. I don't agree with that.
Well, if he's breaking the laws of a country.
You don't let North Korea dictate who can and cannot be on your social media platform. You don't let Putin dictate who gets to be on your social media platform. You don't let Russia dictate. You don't let China dictate. You let your policies that should apply around the world. And if there's a local law that's just BS intended to crush dissidents, is that a price you pay to do business in the country? That's the ethical dilemma we're talking about.
Well, yeah, and I'd agree with that. I would agree with that. Yeah.
But the problem here is like this guy's based in the US. So that makes it all the worse.
Yeah, I mean, and he could be a crackpot for all we know. I mean, he could be saying stuff that's completely and wholly untrue. But at this point, YouTube and Twitter are doing this because they want to be
And Facebook.
They want to be in China. And one way to do that is to penalize this guy who's saying negative things about China. And he's doing it in the U.S. That, I think you're right, is a big deal.
Yeah. And then let's be clear. He's not saying negative things about China, but about corruption.
Correct.
So, you know, that should be a positive thing for China that if you call out corruption. But anyway.
HBO is thinking global and acting local. Wait, come again? Let me read that. HBO is thinking global and acting local. Oh, I get it. Okay. Like Netflix and others, HBO creates original programming all over the world. Sometimes those shows are HBO's biggest hits in those territories, outdrawing even Game of Thrones.
Even Game of Thrones?
Yes, that is the idea, after all. Now they're bringing those shows to the U.S., Taiwan's Teenage Psychic, the Czech Republic's Wasteland, and the Latin American show La Vida Secreta de las Parejas are among the offerings to make their debut on HBO Go, HBO Now, and Via on Demand. Is this a big deal or a big...
by the way.
Yeah, you know, Parejas, you know, I think Bird, right? Or Birds, since it's, Big deal or big whoop?
I can't believe they weren't already available. I'm like, you really? They weren't available on demand? Why the hell would you not have everything available? I was trying to understand that for a second. Is it bandwidth?
I don't know. I thought maybe is it licensing? Wait a second. You made these, so technically you could license them back to yourself. You know, it's. I do know this, that HBO Latin America. I have a friend who works there, and they're on their production side. They are losing certain executives who have been there for decades to Netflix and Apple, and they're really kind of upset about that because, of course, you know, they're losing them to competitors who are just paying more money, more than HBO is paying. And so this kind of local content in Latin America and Europe, it's not only on the rise with HBO, but also all these streaming providers.
Yeah, they all need and want that. But I can't imagine why, if there's any possibility that you wouldn't make them all available everywhere because you don't know where, you know, just seems, why not? But of course, that title in English, I think, means something like The Secret Life of the Couples.
Okay.
Parejas is couples, I believe.
Okay. So I don't know what I'm talking about when it comes to Spanish.
And okay.
I've just proved it. Now, for the second year in a row, an American has won the Man Booker Prize, one of the most prestigious literary prizes in the world. A few years ago, it was opened up to any novel written in English rather than just English language novels from the Commonwealth, you know, all those countries associated with the UK. Last year, Paul Beatty won for his blistering comic novel, The Sellout. This year, it's the literary fantasy work Lincoln in the Bardo, in which dead souls trapped in a graveyard commune with President Lincoln as he mourns the death of his young son. Now, if this sounds familiar, if this book or storyline sounds familiar, it's because Michael featured it during our book filter segment, I want to say, earlier this year. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, that's no big deal that I pointed it out because everybody did. It was one of the most anticipated books of the year, one of the best reviewed, and that's why I think this is a big whoop. I am a little concerned about the Man Booker Prize feeling like losing a little bit of its character, but both of these books are so terrific. You know, it's not that a weak American book has trumped all the others. It's two brilliant American novels have won the Man Booker Prize. So I'm not quite worried yet. Let's give it 5 or 10 years, see how it falls out. But when these two, you know, really terrific books win, I can't be too worried. You know,
what you're saying is when it becomes a popularity contest instead of a contest of, you know, actual merit, then start worrying.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, speaking of merit, CNN is launching a new promotional campaign for the 24-hour news network. Now, here's their boast. They provide facts. That's their claim. A 30-second spot shows a red apple, while a voiceover states the obvious. This is an apple. They go on to say that others might tell you it's a banana. They might say, banana, banana, banana. They might write banana in all caps. You might even start to believe what you are looking at is a banana. But it's not. It's an apple. Yes, a news channel is making its case that they deal in facts, and that separates them from the competition. Big deal or big whoop?
It is big depressing that that has to be an ad campaign for a news outlet. We have facts. It's a funny campaign. I thought it was pretty effective. It stands out. It's different. So, good for them.
Now, do you think they're playing off of the surreal painter Magritte too, where he said,
perhaps.
Yeah. You know, and if you want to know what that is, Google it. And you'll be like, oh, yeah, maybe, yeah. Now, I don't get this next story, Michael, so you're going to have to explain this to me, because in India, young people spend more time watching video and consuming content online than they do on traditional TV. The big screen is still a big winner for video, and of course, mobile is where music lives. And young people in India love YouTube for music, video, and more, but who's telling us all this, and is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. You're just seeing the spread of the smartphone as being a banking system. You know, just as countries skipped over, you know, telephone wires and jumped right to wireless communications, they're using mobile phones to make money payments. They're using it to do banking. They're using it to consume content that we do in America. They just are doing it even more than ever on their phone rather than on a big screen, because maybe they don't have a big screen, or they're just wandering around and that's how they want to live their life. So I think it's interesting. It came from a story on Rapid TV News, okay, just saying that online content consumption is gaining ground in India. This is where the big action is happening. And it reflects what's happening everywhere else in the world. So, you know, I think it's interesting. We can see a couple different things connected to this. In North America, 17% of people using the internet pay for at least one over-the-top streaming service like Netflix. You know, so we're doing it here too. In Russia, pay TV has plateaued. People paying for pay TV, they're not having any more growth in that area. Now, of course, they're trying to make money by adding on new services. Because they've realized they've peaked out. 75% of the country has paid TV and they're not going to grow anymore. So, you know, this is just happening all over the world. Paid TV is reaching a peak. People are turning to their phones and their tablets to get information more and more.
Which is probably why the hit Norwegian drama Shame is coming to Facebook. You know, that still sounds odd, a TV show coming to a social media platform. But, yeah, you know, with football on Twitter and reality shows on Apple and dramas on Facebook, we'll have to get used to it. Shame is a show about teenagers, and it's been on for about 4 seasons, I think, in Scandinavia. What made the show unusual was how it was created. New content was created and shared daily, and it was all online before being packaged and presented on TV. So if you wanted to be first, you were catching it online and commenting and sharing before a single minute was even broadcast on the big screen. Simon Fuller of American Idol is producing the English language version, and really, no points for him for realizing this would be a perfect fit for Facebook. Big deal or big whoop?
I want to say it's a big whoop. And again, it ties into the story we just heard about, that people consume content online. And this show is designed to say, we know that's where you want to get it first. That's where the kids are. So that's why this show was created. And I believe we talked about this when this debuted in Scandinavia. It seems it really rings a bell for me.
And not a virtual bell.
All right. So, yeah. I sent you an email saying, hey, didn't we talk about this? I couldn't figure it out, you know, Googling the show, what episode we talked about it on. But I really think we did, which means, Simon Fuller, what took you so long? If you were listening to Showbiz Sandbox, you would have optioned this show 3 years ago.
Yes, you should actually send us a check for that, by the way.
Well, I think he found out about another way, but he would have been first if he'd listened to Showbiz.
I agree. Now, in a case of shutting the barn door after the cow has escaped, or in this case, the elephant, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo signed a bill that outlaws the use of elephants for entertainment.
No, I am following past the trend long after everybody else has signed on.
Yes, he thinks this Facebook thing is going to be huge. No circuses, no parades, nothing. This comes after the shuttering of the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus and other similar ventures around the world. They've been outpaced by Cirque du Soleil and other human-only spectacles that skip the tigers and bears and add in more aerial stunts and bad music. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. It seems like the nail in the coffin, I guess, but we knew this was coming. We knew it was basically dead already, but he's making it official.
Yes, that's like saying no children workers on silent movies. It's like, okay, fine.
Unless it's Wonderstruck.
Yes, we'll agree to that. Okay, well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And oh my God, I really, you know, you actually in our show notes asked me, are we tired of covering this? And the answer is yes, but we have to.
And my answer is no, that was a setup. I didn't mean to set you up quite that badly, but we have three sections here talking about people paying a price, more women coming forward, and maybe some actual substantive changes beyond the individuals that are being revealed to have been serial predators. But I said, are people tired of covering this? Well, we really shouldn't be, because, you know, this is something that's been going on for decades. And it's spreading. It's not the story of one guy's assortedness behavior. It's a systemic problem, and it's not going to go away in a day. And we should be talking about it for years to come, because it's going to take a long time to clean up this mess and maybe change the culture. You know, there's no witch hunt going on. These women have known these men as predators for years, but nobody would listen to them. Many of them have come forward before, or sued, or taken action with their human resources department. They have story after story of coming ahead and saying, help, and people ignoring them or punishing them, or them losing their job. So, you know, tired of covering it? Oh, sorry. Maybe they were tired of decades of sexual harassment.
Well, okay. So now some of these men are paying a price. So why don't we go over what's happened during the past week?
That's right. What happened to Harvey Weinstein?
Well, he quit the board of the Weinstein Company. The company
he already kicked off.
No, he was fired as the CEO, I think, or basically, I think he was still the chairman. So now he's no longer on the board. He's no longer associated with the company in any way, shape, or form.
And New York, Los Angeles, and London police people are investigating charges against him, including a new LA rape charge that allegedly took place in 2013. So he's far from out of the woods yet, legally speaking, that's for sure.
Right. Well, in some of these countries, like France, I don't think there is a statute of limitations on rape. So,
all right.
So he's not going to be out of the woods in many of these instances. If they're provable, the problem is, are they provable? I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a, you know, police officer or prosecutor.
That's why they investigate and decide whether to bring charges.
Correct.
You don't have to be. They'll make the decision for you.
Well, that's good. Now, another person who got into some hot water is Roy Price, who was the head of Amazon Studios. And there was an allegation against him, I guess, 2 weeks ago. He kind of was suspended without pay last week. And this week he stepped down. Or I should say last week he stepped down.
That's right. So that's a big change. So he's gone from that company. Even more interesting to me is that Nickelodeon, they fired Chris Savino. He's the creator of their number two show. It's The Loud House. And unfortunately, a dozen women and counting have come forward with stories of sexual harassment from Chris Savino. This is the second season of this show, The Loud House. It's their number two show, ranked behind only SpongeBob SquarePants. So the fact that they fired him, a guy who's on a show where normally that's the sort of person that would get as much protection as possible, to me, that's really significant. I mean, the show's not going away. The show's going to continue. But firing the creator two seasons in, that's a really big deal that they're taking this seriously. So there's a lot going on in the animation world. And we'll get to more women who've come forward in that venue down the road.
Well, and then there, you know, is this APA agent, Tyler Grasham. He was fired by one of the stars of Stranger Things, Finn Wolfhard, and he was placed on leave as multiple men came forward to say he harassed and or assaulted them, and he got them drunk and, you know, tried to take advantage of them, and now he's fired.
Yeah, this is a guy where a number of young, and we're talking about getting guys drunk when they're like teenagers, 15, 16, 17, telling them, oh, it's how the business works, that sort of thing. And again, just as with the women, these guys say, you know, you feel embarrassed, you feel ashamed. Is it your fault? Why did you go to his house in the first place? You know, you shouldn't have taken the drink. Maybe this is how it works. Or you just feel like an idiot for letting yourself be put in a situation where he could hit on you or get you drunk. And that shame and embarrassment keeps you from reporting what is harassment. You know, he shouldn't do it. It's wrong. It's illegal. So it's great that they're coming forward. And it's not just men hitting on women. It's men hitting on men. We have Netflix. They paid $1.5 million to a former human resources director who worked there for months and alleges widespread acceptance of sexual harassment. Straight man hit on by a gay superior, All sorts of things that he talked about. Netflix offering 1 year off for new parents, but says if you actually take it off, God help you, your job is going to, you know, disappear because they really don't want you to do that. And if you do that, they won't take you seriously. So they've paid out $1.5 million to him. So the more people get payments, the more people sue. Even if it's a secret settlement, eventually it's going to come out.
Now, you know, it's funny because yesterday on Sunday, the LA Times had this big story about James Toback, who is a director known for The Pickup Artist, probably, and a number of other films. He did a documentary about Mike Tyson. And, you know, it alleges that 30 women have come forward saying that James Toback has sexually harassed him or harassed them. And in a way, this is one of those things where everybody knew this about James Toback. I mean, he was kind of a sleazy guy.
Right, but he always said his modus operandi was just that, and I've interviewed him, I think, at one point. And of course, he was Oscar nominated for Bugsy. He's, you know, he's worked with Warren Beatty over the years. You know, he's got quite a lot of good credits to his name. But his modus operandi, he said, was you just ask everybody. Just, oh, hey, you're really attractive. Do you want to have sex? He said, you'll get rejected 99% of the time, but one person each day will say yes, and then you get to have sex. You right. know, it sounded cute and straightforward, not what is described here as sleazy and god-awful and horrifying. And again, it comes down to, you know, auditions. And women come to audition, and he tells them, you know, take off your top. And like, well, I don't really feel comfortable. It's like, well, come on. If you can't get naked in front of a crew, you can't get naked in front of me. How can you get naked in front of a crew? Look at all these women who I've made stars and these people I've worked with. And they're like, oh, God, then maybe that makes sense. And they embarrass. They feel silly. They feel stupid. But they do it, you know. And again, we talked about last week or the week before, you like no more private auditions. How about no nudity in auditions? Should there ever be nudity in auditions? Maybe for adult films? I don't know. But even if you're going to do a nudity in a film, do you have to get naked for the audition? Maybe SAG could say, you know what? No nudity. You can't do it. You can't ask for it, and they can't offer to do it. I don't know. But yeah, this is like the least shocking revelation. I'm sure you're right. Yeah, he's a sleazy, hit on high school students, masturbated in front of women, grinded on them. I mean, it's just the stories really make you kind of upset.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting is like he's so not known. He's such not a household name that he would have to carry DVDs around to say, look,
and
that's
news
me.
Articles. Say, yes. Look, I'm a real guy.
Yeah, right. I made movies with Robert Downey Jr., three of them. And yeah, so it's just like he was, I mean, I don't know. Yes, I've interviewed him in the past as well. This storyline stretches all the way to Vox, which is a media outlet, an online media outlet where their editorial director, Lockhart Steele, was fired over misconduct as well.
Yes, and he has a name of a porn star.
I know.
Lockhart Steele. And this looks like fired over misconduct after just one online accusation, as far as I can tell. But other people point out, look, this guy was probably going to leave in a month anyway. He also worked at Gawker, which also has issues with being a bad workplace for women. Vox says their investigation is ongoing, so it'll be nice to hear more details. But there's a gaming forum website. You know, we know the gamer world is rife with misogyny. And the gaming website NeoGAF, this is a forum where people talk about video games. That site is down, and people have fled it amid accusations that the site owner, Tyler Evalor Malka, has been harassing women. A number of women online have generated a list that they have dubbed "Shitty Media Men," in which they detail harassment and things that have happened at workplaces and others by men.
They have to be careful about that. That they have to be careful about.
Well, because, sure. Sometimes they don't even tell the place of business or the person involved. But,
okay,
these are women coming forward saying, sue me. They don't have to be careful if it's true. Sue me, they say. I'm happy to be sued. Let's go to court. You know, this is the point. Being scared to speak up and speak open. If it's true, you know, yes, you'll have to have legal fees and you'll have to have abuses, but bring it on is what some of them are saying.
Well, and then there's two people. The first I'd like to say is Scott Rosenberg, who is a screenwriter of a number of, I think, Con Air and Beautiful Girls. And, you know, he came out and he's a friend of mine on Facebook. He's a Facebook friend. And he said, look, everyone knew about Harvey Weinstein. We all knew, and it was this really well-written kind of personal confession about dealing with Harvey Weinstein over the years. And I remember thinking, wow, this should really be made public because he wrote it on Facebook. And then, of course,
isn't that public?
Not necessarily. It was made public because people urged him, hey, you should make this public. And then finally, Quentin Tarantino kind of came out and he said, I knew enough to do more than I did.
Yeah, Quentin Tarantino gave an hour-long interview to the New York Times, talking at length about how much his career was championed by Harvey Weinstein and how much the guy meant to him and how devastating this is. Obviously, not as much to him as to the women who were assaulted. But I thought he was one of the first people to say, you know what, I did. I knew enough to do more than I did. It doesn't mean I knew he raped people, but I knew enough and I should have done more. And I thought that was, you know, admirable. Let's not go overboard for men doing what they should have done decades ago. But at least he took that step and a lot of other people didn't. And he said, you know, he dated Mira Sorvino. She told him what Harvey Weinstein did. And he said he just brushed it off as like, well, he must be obsessed with her. And I think she's great too. And now I'm dating her. So he's clearly not going to mess with her because she's my girl. And another actress told him a similar story. And to his credit, he said he confronted Harvey and made him apologize to the woman, even though it was a pretty weak apology. He'd heard about Rose McGowan. But the overall thing is that he really knows that he failed. And he says, what I did was marginalize the incidents. Anything I say now will sound like a crappy excuse.
You know, it's interesting about Quentin Tarantino, okay? Both as a filmmaker and as a human being, when you interview him, he's got, in a way, no filter. Like, you know everything he's thinking because he's so manic that everything he thinks comes out of his mouth. So in a way, he probably has thought about this, and now what he's saying is actually, you can actually believe.
Yeah. Well, and there's reason to believe the women as more and more of them come forward. You can't help. The stories are sad and depressing of how omnipresent they are. I mean, when I think of women being taken advantage of and the casting couch, I think I probably always pictured the women who didn't have talent, the women who didn't make it. The women who were prey and more willing or more willing to be put in a compromising position. Not that that's their fault, but I probably just figured people on the margins is what I imagined. I never imagined like every major actress I've ever heard of. Reese Witherspoon came forward and said she was sexually assaulted by a director when she was 16 years old. She's been harassed and assaulted multiple times. And she feels ashamed for being silent. And she shouldn't feel ashamed. She should just be proud that she's finally coming forward. Molly Ringwald talked about all the other Harveys in Hollywood. She says when she was 13, a 13 years old, a 50-year-old crew member said he'd show her how to dance and then shoved up against her with an erection. When she was 14, a married director shoved his tongue down her throat on set.
How does that happen? And like nobody say anything.
She was humiliated in an audition when a director out of nowhere asked her to wear a dog collar, which had nothing to do with the film whatsoever. And an actor that she was doing the scene opposite, who she thought was cute and kind of had a crush on, he looked apologetic as he reached over and started to put a dog collar on her. And she went out to her car. She cried. She called her agent. And he sort of laughed and said, oh, well, that's one for the memoirs. And she fired him and moved to Paris. And that's how Molly Ringwald for years was gone. She left the country, moved to Paris. And you're kind of like, well, that's unusual and interesting. And that's what triggered it. Amanda Siegel, a producer on The Mist, says she was harassed by Bob Weinstein. And it went on for months until her lawyer officially informed the company of what was happening. He says he just asked her out. He never touched her. He never whatever. It's a legal issue. But it's like when you're working for someone on a film or TV show and they keep asking you out, that is an impossible situation and one you shouldn't be put in.
Now wait a second. This Amanda Siegel one, I have to say, the reason that this did not get a lot of play here is because
I thought it did.
Well, it did, but then it quickly died down. Is because when you read the accounts, you go, hey, Bob, you know, you're really not good at this whole, like, you're really not good. You're not good with the women. And, oh, by the way, you're kind of an abusive jerk in the office as well, and the two combined don't do well. There's also been some question about she's kind of done this in the past with other bosses as well, kind of brought these accusations against other people in the past at other workplaces. So I think it quickly became, and I'm again, this is all alleged. So
well, we know it's widespread. So the fact that she's come forward before and not been believed doesn't mean it's not true. Good point. Bob Weinstein didn't deny it. He just said, even if I did what was described, it wasn't harassment. Meaning, maybe I did ask her out on multiple dates again and again and again and again and again, to which she kept saying no, but that's not harassment. But when your boss is asking you on a, when you're working on a TV series with them, that is harassment.
Yes, that's true.
And again, I misread this story because I had to read it twice before I realized it wasn't another story about Harvey. I was like, oh, wait, Bob. Oh, my God. Oh, Bob, the other guy. Sean Young says Harvey Weinstein exposed himself to her, and she says she was chastised by Barbara Streisand for speaking out.
What?
Barbara Streisand was like, I can't believe you went public with that. Like, deal with it and move on, was what Sean Young describes as Barbara Streisand's reaction.
I'm surprised Barbara Streisand hasn't said anything about that.
A comic writer on It's Gary Shandling show, Janice Hirsch. She was the only woman on staff. She wrote two of the first six episodes. She thought, wow, I've really made it. And then she was slowly squeezed out of meetings, then assigned only the slit scenes, which it took her a while to figure out what they meant when they said that. And then at a meeting, an actor draped his flaccid penis on her shoulder, and everybody laughed. Ha, ha, ha. And she didn't laugh. And the next day she had a meeting with Brad Gray thinking, oh, wow, okay, thank God people are recognizing it. And he said, yeah, maybe you should quit.
Wow.
She went on to work on The Nanny and Frasier. And that's like, that's the classic, oh, you can't take a joke, loosen up, you know, women are so uptight. Oh, ha, ha, ha. Emma Klein, an author, talked about sexual harassment. Women in publishing have come forward. 80% of the employees in the U.S. publishing industry are estimated to be women. 80%. This is an industry dominated by women. And the other 20% of men, a lot of them are gay. And yet, there is a sexual harassment problem in publishing, and women have come forward with their stories. I mean, it's really spreading far, far beyond film and Harvey Weinstein.
I thought the Lupita Nyong'o story was very, very interesting because she describes in detail the interaction she had with Harvey Weinstein. And it kind of shows, it was a lens into how that relationships worked.
Let's not call it a relationship, but yeah, the abuse of power. Yeah, he was basically really blunt. He's like, sleep with me and I'll give you roles. I mean, she said he didn't even pretend. It wasn't even like sugarcoated. And then he was blunt and he's like, don't be naive. This is how it works. You sleep with me, I get you a better role. So it was it's sad and depressing. And yet what's not depressing is the fact that people are finally talking about it. 200 female animators. You never think of the animation industry as having a lot of women in it, and clearly they don't, and the ones who are there are not very happy. They've got an open letter talking about the problems in the animation industry, and they're saying, quote, some have seen the entrance of more women into the industry as an opportunity to exploit and victimize younger workers on their crews who are looking for mentorship. In addition, when sexual predators are caught at one workplace, they seem to easily find a job at another studio, sometimes even following their victims from job to job. We are tired of relying on whisper networks to know who isn't safe to meet with alone. We want our supervisors to protect us from harassment and assault. This abuse has got to stop.
Wow. So that we went through a laundry list of
And this
stories.
Is 1 week's just yes. A grab bag of the stuff we saw. It's not even remotely comprehensive.
Yeah, that's part of the, you know, it's like a wave of these types of stories, almost like a dam bursting.
And what are these female animators, what are some of the specific demands they want?
Well, they want clear and enforceable sexual harassment policies at every studio.
I can't believe they don't have that already.
Yeah, that's true. Amendments to the Animation Guild Constitution to censure, fine, suspend, or expel members who are found guilty of any act, omission, or conduct which is prejudicial to the welfare of the guild, and support for male colleagues to start speaking up and standing up for them.
Well, that seems reasonable. And some people have pointed to the secret settlements as a big problem. They say maybe that shouldn't end. Maybe you shouldn't be able to have secret settlements.
Well, I think California lawmakers are proposing that very law, in fact.
Right. So they're going to make a secret settlements for sexual harassment, assault, or rape will be illegal. They must be made public. To which I say, then, of course, part of the settlement will be the fact that they won't agree to call it sexual harassment, assault, or rape. They'll call it something else. But you think that, and yet Bill O'Reilly came to a settlement for a woman for non-consensual sexual relations. What the hell is that other than rape? That's the one where he paid her $32 million and now wants to claim, well, I was just protecting my kids from, you know, an ugly court scene. That's why I paid her $32 million. So, yeah, you know, anybody who sued and made a settlement, good for you. Because when you find out Harvey Weinstein's paid out 8 or 10 times or Bill O'Reilly's paid out $45 million, the idea that you can kid yourself that they were just paying people to go away, give me a break.
Well, okay, if you really want to listen to an interesting story, The Daily, which is a podcast from the New York Times for October 23rd, actually has the two journalists who broke the story about Bill O'Reilly back in April and now again, which led to his being terminated from Fox News. They go and interview him for the first time, and they're talking about how they walked across New York City, you know, on down 40th Street to meet him on the East River, and their own apprehension and their own nervousness and what that interview was like. It's a behind the scenes view of how that news was gathered and what it felt like to, you know, face the person you were writing about face to face in person. It's fascinating.
Well, and we were talking last week about Megyn Kelly on the Today Show.
Yes.
And how she needs to sort of, you know, reboot her relationship with her audience and somehow come across and somehow make work in that time frame. Well, today, you know, she came forward and talked about how she complained directly at Fox about Bill O'Reilly's behavior. The network or some people claimed that nobody had complained about him before. She said that's not true. She posted a letter that she sent to Fox on air, showed the entire letter and what she complained about and her specific charges and what she was worried about. And she brought a woman on to talk about the case, a woman who had sued Bill O'Reilly successfully. And she was tearful, which is what one does on the Today Show. It is, emotions are encouraged. So that's a very different Megyn Kelly than you see in primetime. And it's certainly a different one than we've seen in the morning. Whether it will help long term, I don't know. But if there's a storyline she can own, surely it is sexual harassment, because that's why she left Fox.
That's
why
right.
She felt unwelcome there and that she had to walk away even after Roger Ailes was gone.
That's right.
But the tabloid journals aren't done yet. Everybody is talking about her ratings. And I think it was Us Weekly had a cover story where they showed Megyn Kelly and they said, you know, ratings are falling and there's a big blow up between her and Matt Lauer. One of them is going to be fired. And I'm like, well, if one of them is going to be fired, it sure as hell isn't Matt Lauer.
Yeah. Let's review. One's been there for umpteen years and one hasn't.
Yeah. So when it gets to the tabloid level of them talking about your ratings, that's not a good thing.
That's true.
But good for her to come forward with the information that she had and to make that a focus, because she can speak to it better than a lot of people.
That's true. And we can speak to the entertainment industry better than a lot of people. In fact, we did for the last probably 9.5 hours or however long this show was.
It's about the length of the Harry Potter 2-part play.
That's true, which we will not charge you for. In fact, all we ask is that you go and subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere. They give podcasts away for free. Our show usually can be found. If you can't find it, please let us know. You can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. That number is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. We're also on Facebook, where you can like our page, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. All of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to contact us and subscribe to us. Also, all the links to all the stories we've discussed on today's show are on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. And indeed, they have a new album coming out next year. And the first song, Little Dark Age, has been released. It's pretty good. You should check it out. There's a video for it, and we'll place a link to it in our show notes. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's imaverifiedfan.com.
Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage on the entertainment industry at that particular website, or if it's just too darn expensive or it doesn't load within the first 3 hours, why not head on over to the Huffington Post or michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.